Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm EQMM's editor, Janet Hutchings. Featured in our podcast series this month is a tale by short story specialist Michael Bracken. With over 1,000 published stories to his credit, the Texas author may be the most prolific short story writer currently at work in our genre. And the quality of those many stories is high, earning multiple Derringer Awards and an Edward D. Hope Memorial Golden Derringer for Lifetime Achievement. The author did this recording for us at the Malice Domestic Convention earlier this year. The story appears in print in EQMM's current issue, July-August 2019. Here is Michael Bracken reading Oysterman.
Christopher Corby glared at Chesapeake Bay through his den's picture window and then turned to his wife, Lila. That son of a bitch is out there again. An oyster boat bobbed in the water 100 feet from shore, contaminating Corby's Wednesday morning view. Dressed in waders, a lightweight waterproof jacket, and thick, cut-resistant gloves, the lone oysterman crewing the boat hauled cages to the surface, removed mature oysters, and dropped the cages back into the water. After admiring her reflection in the glass front of the gun cabinet, Lila glanced at her watch. "You'd better leave soon," she insisted, "or you'll miss your meeting." Corby glared out the window one last time before stomping through his 6-bedroom French provincial home to the attached 3-car garage. A few minutes later, he exited the driveway in the black Porsche 911 he had given himself for his 50th birthday. He turned toward the city. Oyster War, that's what the local newspaper called it. Oystermen and homeowners were battling for control of the public waterways. Increased demand for oysters, coinciding with new farming methods and cleaner water, had made Chesapeake Bay oyster farming profitable again after decades during which only a few hard-luck oystermen kept the faith. Wealthy homeowners, most of whom built their waterfront McMansions during the oyster drought, were unaccustomed to cages, warning signs, and dead-rise workboats cluttering their view. So the battle began. Homeowners believed they had the right to unimpeded views. They claimed the proximity of the oystermen invaded their privacy, and that the cages and markers near the shoreline made boating and swimming less safe. The oystermen, all of whom had properly obtained their shellfish leases, claimed their right to earn a living. Neither side would budge, and disagreements often erupted into violent arguments, thrown punches, and police intervention. Corby, among the most vocal homeowners, had thrown more money and threatening rhetoric than actual punches in the fight to revoke existing and quash new shellfish leases in the public waters along the shoreline of his upscale enclave. As such, he made no friends among the locals, but became the de facto leader of his neighborhood's homeowners association. Ernie Lund, holder of the lease offshore from the Corby property, smelled of sweat and seawater. His boat docked and that morning's haul delivered. He sat alone in a booth at the High Tide, a wharfside tavern catering to the blue-collar men and women who worked in, on, and around the waterways. And he nursed the first of several beers he would down that afternoon. He came from a line of oystermen stretching back several generations, though his father long earned a better living repairing the watercraft of the wealthy than tonguing oysters from the family's leased beds. The surge in demand, cleaner water, and use of cages allowed Lund to earn more farming oysters than his father ever had. But earlier that day, he found a way to supplement his income. All he needed was a small video camera with a high-powered zoom lens to capture the activities of Mrs. Corby. 2 years younger than her husband, and pushing hard against 50, Lila Cathcart Corby still maintained her college silhouette, a silhouette that attracted Lund's attention a few weeks earlier when she stood at her second-floor bedroom window, lamplight shining through her diaphanous white negligee. Too far away to discern details, Lund nonetheless watched until she turned away, and he continued monitoring Lila's activities whenever he harvested oysters offshore of the Corby property. That morning, not long after Christopher Corby drove away, Lila welcomed a visitor. Lund noticed. He also noticed when the curtains in one of the guest bedrooms fluttered. Gordon Sikora interrupted Lund's reverie when he tossed a copy of that morning's newspaper, folded open to the editorial page, on the table as he slid into the booth opposite Lund. Corby's written another letter to the editor. Like Lund, Sikora harvested oysters, but his shellfish leases were up bay from Lund's, where homeowners were less affluent, but no less vocal. Though not related by blood, the two men considered themselves family. Lund didn't bother reaching for the paper. "You have anything new to say?" "Same shit, different words," Sikora said. "He wants to take away our livelihood." "Man should look inside his house before he looks outside." "How's that?" Lund shook his head, looked at his empty beer bottle, and said, "You buying the next round, or am I?" 38-year-old Stanton Perry, having never worked a day in his life, but having spent a great many days working the wives of those who did, fulfilled the physical needs of wealthy women emotionally abandoned by hard-driving spouses. He met them at gallery openings, museum fundraisers, and symphony galas, and the gifts he received for his devoted attention supplemented his modest income from a trust fund established years earlier by his grandfather. Lila Cathcart Corby was the latest in a string of middle-aged married women who welcomed his midday visits, and she was easily the most attractive, most insatiable, and most generous in recent experience. He parked his Toyota Camry in the circular drive of the Corby residence, washed a blue pill down with a swallow from a lukewarm bottle of water, and slipped out of his car. She was waiting in the open doorway before he even reached the porch, wearing a white negligee that revealed still firm breasts and a Pilates-taut abdomen. Biweekly visits to the salon to dye and highlight her hair masked threads of gray. Only up close, where one could see lines at the corners of her eyes beneath her makeup, did her age become evident. She covered his mouth with hers as soon as he stepped inside. The following Wednesday, Ernie Lund spotted Stanton Perry's Camry as it approached the Corby Drive. When he saw drapes flutter in one of the second-floor guest rooms, he dropped an oyster cage back in the water and grabbed his new video camera. Though the telephoto lens was powerful enough for him to discern the pattern on the drapes, Lund could not get a clear view of whatever activity engaged the room's occupants because the balcony railing blocked much of his view. He swore, stopped recording, and resumed harvesting oysters. Lund was luckier the following Wednesday when Lila stepped onto the balcony wearing her diaphanous white negligee. He had the video camera ready when Perry followed. She said something. The younger man responded by pulling her into his arms. He pushed the straps of the negligee from her shoulders and it slid down, caught for a moment at her hips, and then fell to her feet. Perry spun Lila around, wrapped his arms around her from behind, and kissed her neck. She pulled away, took his hand, and led him inside. Lund stopped recording, certain he had more than enough. He secured the video camera, finished his work for the day, and headed to the dock. Ernie Lund sat nursing a beer in his favorite booth at the high tide. His morning had proven far more productive than anticipated, and he pondered the next step. His thoughts were interrupted when Gordon Sikora slid into the booth opposite him. "There's a meeting tonight," Sikora said. "You going?" "I wouldn't miss it." The Virginia Marine Resources Commission had scheduled an open public meeting to discuss the backlog of new shellfish lease applications. A third of all applications faced opposition, and the commission sought input on how to streamline the process and reduce the backlog. Waterfront homeowners wanted a blanket rejection on all new applications, while oystermen wanted every application rubber-stamped. Legislators joined the fray, and proposals floating around the statehouse included giving landowners power to block new leases and raising the annual lease fees from mere dollars to thousands of dollars per acre. None of which appeared to favor oystermen who lacked the political clout that came with deep pockets. When Lund and Sikora arrived that evening, they found the meeting room already divided by loyalties. Oystermen and long-term residents occupied the left side, while the McMansion dwellers occupied the right. After Lund joined the oystermen, he looked across the room and saw Christopher and Lila Cathcart Corby huddled with a group of their neighbors. Like many of the men on his side of the room, Lund wore a plaid shirt, well-worn blue jeans, and thick-soled waterproof work boots. His entire wardrobe cost less than Corby's red silk tie, which the homeowner wore loosened over a white dress shirt. The jacket of Corby's blue pinstripe suit had been tossed casually over the back of a chair. The meeting began with the usual bureaucratic welcoming of attendees and a formal statement of the meeting's objectives. Then it degenerated into a shouting match between sides of the room. As always, the meeting was a battle between the desire to earn a living on one side and safety, privacy, and the demand for unimpeded views on the other. Because neither side would back down, Lund and Corby soon stood only inches apart, shouting obscenities with such force that their spittle speckled each other's clothing. When it appeared Corby was about to take a swing at Lund, Sikora grabbed Lund's arm to pull him back. "Go ahead and hit me, Mr. Corby," Lund shouted. "Hit you," Corby shouted back. "I should just shoot you, you low-life wharf rat." Sikora pulled hard on Lund as the Virginia Marine Resources Commission representative gaveled the unproductive meeting to a close, and three other oystermen joined him in walking Lund to the door. "Richie Rich over there thinks he can push us around," Lund groused to the men surrounding him. "Well, he can take his fancy house and shove it where oysters only exit. I've got that SOB right where I want him." The following morning, Ernie Lund stood on the Corby front porch, a video camera hanging from one hand. He leaned into the bell. A moment later, Lila opened the door. Her eyes opened wide with surprise as she crossed her arms over her breasts, covering what her diaphanous white negligee failed to. "I know who you are," she said. "What do you want?" "I brought something to show you, something your husband might be interested in seeing." Lund held up the video camera, pressed play, and turned the LCD display so she could watch her balcony encounter with Stanton Perry. After less than a minute, she shifted her gaze from the display to Lund's eyes. "And you want something from me so you won't show it to him?" "I'm certain we can make some kind of mutually beneficial arrangement," he suggested. "You're an attractive man, Mr. Lund." Lila placed one hand on his forearm, no longer bothering to cover herself. "I'm certain we can work something out." Lund snorted with disgust. "If any man can have you, what man would want you?" Offended, Lila stood straighter, anger boiling in her eyes. "Money, Mrs. Corby. I want money." After several minutes of haggling, they settled on an agreeable figure, and Lund drove away, passing Perry on his way to visit Lila, a drive Lund would repeat several more times during the coming months. Late one Friday afternoon, Perry answered his cell phone. Before he could speak, he heard Lila's voice. "I need to see you tonight." "Tonight?" Perry said. "What about..." "He's just left for the weekend, on a hunting trip," she said. Though her grandfather taught her to shoot during summer vacations in Missouri, she never joined her husband's hunting trips. "He won't be back until Sunday afternoon." "Are you certain?" "Of course I am," Lila insisted. "I can be there in an hour, maybe an hour and a half." "I'll be waiting." And she was, though she had chosen a black nightgown he'd never before seen. "You like it?" Lila asked as she modeled for him. "I do," she said. "I bought it just for you." He held out his hand as she came into his arms, ravenous, insistent, demanding. Later, in one of the guest beds, Lila rose up on one elbow and looked down at Perry. "Do you love me?" She drew random designs in his chest hair. "Yes," he said. He knew better than to give any other answer. "I love you. Do you want to be with me forever?" "Of course," Perry said. "But you're married. That can change." Corby returned from his unsuccessful hunting trip late Sunday night and returned his rifle to the gun cabinet in the den. Before she let him head upstairs to unpack and shower, Lila reminded him to take the garbage can to the curb for pickup the next morning. Good weather all weekend and predicted until midweek meant oystermen would dot the bay come Monday morning. She counted on it, and over breakfast the following morning, she ensured that her husband saw Lund hard at work offshore from their waterfront property. "There's no end to that man's gall," Lila said. "I think he sits out there every morning just to piss you off." "Well, he does a pretty damn good job." "Too bad you can't do something about it." "Like what?" Corby demanded. "I've written letters to the editor, been to every public meeting, lobbied our delegates and our senators." "You'd think they would listen to a man of your influence." Corby slapped the breakfast table. The silverware rattled. "There has to be a way to get that damn man and all the others like him the hell away from our beaches." "If there is," she said, "you'll find it." "Damn right I will." Angry, Corby pushed back his chair and stormed through the house toward the garage, stopping beside the gun cabinet for one last look out at Chesapeake Bay and at the oysterman who defiled his view and defied his efforts to be removed. The next day, Gordon Sikora sat in Ernie Lund's favorite booth at the high tide and stared at that morning's newspaper headline, "Oyster War Turns Deadly." Another oysterman had found Ernie Lund dead in his boat, a single gunshot wound to the chest, and the police had not taken long to pinpoint Corby as the source of the shot. They confiscated all the rifles in the gun cabinet. The rancor between Lund and Corby was well known, and the newspaper printed speculation that Lund's death was related to the ongoing battle between oystermen and waterfront homeowners, speculation that only increased during the following days when one of Corby's rifles proved to be the murder weapon. The homeowner was arrested and charged with Lund's murder. Corby had the bad luck to appear before a judge whose father, grandfather, and great-grandfather had been oystermen. His bail was set inordinately high, so high that he chose to remain in jail rather than pay it. He hired expensive, high-powered defense attorneys. Despite protesting his innocence and his adamant refusal to plea bargain down to a lesser charge, the evidence was stacked against him. His threat before a crowded room to shoot Lund, his recently fired hunting rifle with no fingerprints on it but his, and neighbors who saw him speeding away from home around the time Lund was shot. No other suspects surfaced, despite the tepid efforts of local police to develop alternative theories of the crime. The prosecution could not force Lila to testify against her husband, and the defense chose not to put her on the stand. A jury of Corby's peers, all of whom turned out to be long-time, low-income local residents, unable to finagle their way out of jury duty, convicted him of the premeditated murder of Ernie Lund. The day Corby was sentenced, Lila served him with divorce papers, and 2 months later, Stanton Perry joined her in the Corby home. After Lund's murder, Gordon Secora learned he was the primary beneficiary of Lund's estate, and local homicide detectives interviewed, considered, and dismissed him as a suspect in Lund's death before allowing him access to Lund's property. Secora worked his shellfish leases each day and spent each evening cleaning out Lund's home. The dead oysterman turned out to be a pack rat. With a two-bedroom bungalow and accompanying detached one-car garage crammed full of old fishing and oyster harvesting equipment, Secora separated what he could use from what he planned to sell, and he threw a lot of junk into a rented dumpster. Because he started in the garage and then worked his way through the living room and kitchen toward the back of Lund's home, several months passed following Corby's conviction before Secora discovered a thick roll of cash tucked into an otherwise empty tub of Goop hand cleaner stashed beneath Lund's bathroom sink. He sat on the toilet and slowly counted several thousand dollars, money he felt confident Lund had not legally earned. "Why is that damn boat still out there?" Perry asked one morning when he saw Gordon Secora sitting in Ernie Lund's Dead Rise workboat offshore from the Corby property. Secora had inherited Lund's shellfish leases, but was waiting for the Virginia Marine Resources Commission to approve the transfer of ownership before he began harvesting. What interested him more was the video he'd found on Lund's camera when he'd finally gotten around to viewing it. And he was sitting in Lund's boat watching the Corby home in an attempt to understand what had been in Lund's mind when he'd made the recording. He well remembered Lund's comment that Corby should look inside his house before he looks outside. When Secora finally motored away, he felt reasonably confident the hidden cash and the video were connected to his friend's death. Until the Oyster War began, Secora had no reason to cross paths with the kind of people who lived in waterfront McMansions. But over time, he had become familiar with their habits. After he identified the man in the video with Lila Cathcart Corby as the man who moved into her home following her husband's incarceration, he found a way to meet Stanton Perry. He suggested they discuss something of mutual importance. When they did, Secora showed the video to Perry. Perry watched for a moment and then said, "So?" "Look at the date at the bottom," Secora said. "Mrs. Corby was still married when this was taken." "Which means what?" "I think your main squeeze was being blackmailed by Ernie Lund. I think one of you killed him and framed her husband." Perry shook his head. "That's ludicrous." "So, if it wasn't you, I would watch my back," Secora said. "Mrs. Corby's killed one man and put another on death row. You think she'd have any qualms about doing something similar to you?" "What do you want from me?" Secora said, "If police reopen the case, you could lose your ride on the gravy train. You'll have to go back to hustling lonely old married women." "You want something to make you forget about this?" "Oh, I'm not likely to forget about this," Secora said, "and I've made backup copies so that it won't ever have to." "So what do you want?" "I want to know that my friend didn't die in vain," Secora said. "I want the Oyster War to end." "How am I supposed to accomplish that?" "Mrs. Corby has a lot of influence with the other homeowners now that her husband's in prison. She can call for an end to the hostilities. A lot of the steam has dissipated from our side, too, with Ernie's death. As long as everyone believes he was killed because of the Oyster War, they might feel compelled to find common ground and bring these hostilities to a close. If anyone discovers Lund was killed to hide Mrs. Corby's infidelity, all hell will break loose, Sikora said. Worse, you're likely to be incriminated as an accessory before or after the fact, and you wouldn't want that, would you? Is that all? Sikora shook his head. I think Mrs. Corby should hire me to advise her in her dealings with the Oystermen, and that she should provide me with a reasonable retainer. Blackmail? The Oysterman shook his head. Everything above board and legal. Why would she do that? Sikora tapped the video camera. I think I have one hell of a resume. Lila had never told Perry about the video, but he knew enough when he returned home that evening to spell everything out for her, and he knew he wanted nothing to do with any of it. He waited until they were sharing a bottle of wine in the den before he told her about his meeting with Sikora and his viewing of the video. He told her what Sikora wanted and that he wanted nothing to do with any of it. But Stanton, honey, Lila said as she grabbed his arm, I did it for us. I did it so we could be together. I'd rather bed a dozen geriatric women than spend another night with you. You don't mean that, do you? The bright lights inside the house made it difficult to see outside, though anyone outside could clearly see everything they were doing. Perry shook off Lila's grip and turned away from her, stepping closer to the window to look across the Chesapeake Bay. Behind him, she grabbed the wine bottle by the neck and swung it like a baseball bat at the side of Perry's head, dropping him to the floor. She found herself staring out the window in the same direction Perry had been looking, and she saw Sikora standing in Lund's Dead Rise workboat, Lund's video camera in one hand and his cell phone in the other. Perry survived with little more than a splitting headache and later found steady employment at a spa that catered to lonely women. Corby was released and returned to his former life, while Lila was convicted on several charges and sent to the women's penitentiary. Sikora never told anyone about the cash he found under Lund's sink. The Virginia Marine Resources Commission approved the transfer of Lund's leases to him, and every morning that he works Lund's former shellfish leases, Corby waves to him.
Oysterman is copyrighted by Michael Bracken. Music for this podcast, entitled Deadlock, was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Mixing was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.ellerycueenmysterymagazine.com.